Welcome, everyone. Today is February 3rd, 2011, and this is the second panel session in the ongoing Sessions for Ontology Summit 2011. Today's topic is the Ontology Application Framework. My name is Michael Gruninger. I'm a professor at the University of Toronto, and I will be joined as a co-chair today with Michael Eschel from Semantic Arts. In addition, our two other panelists will be Neil Olbers from MITRE and Professor Alan Rector from the University of Manchester. Our objective for today is that panelists will be presenting various ideas for a straw man proposal, for a framework for different ontology applications. The idea will be that this will be a framework that we can use to classify different kinds of applications, and it will be used to organize the different use cases that are proposed by other tracks within the summit. In terms of the order of speakers, due to some scheduling constraints, what we will do is we will have Michael Eschel present first, followed by Leo Olbers. And after that, I will present a few notes, and then we'll be finishing up with Alan Rector. And then after that, we will just open it up for a wide-ranging discussion session. We really want this to be a kind of a brainstorming session and to be able to get enough material that we can continue the discussion virtually online between now and the face-to-face in April. I also encourage everyone, if you're new to these ontolog sessions, I encourage people to post their questions and their comments within the chat session, and hopefully we'll be able to respond to all of the different issues during our later discussion. Mike, if you would like to begin. And remind you also, people, that you can download the presentation material, the different slides for each of the speakers, off of the conference call site. Michael, go ahead.
Okay. Hi, thank you very much. I'm Michael Eschel, and I'm currently a senior ontology consultant with Semantic Arts, a small software consultancy. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about today is actually a talk that I gave 12 years ago, believe it or not. Rob Jasper and I put our heads together and figured out a framework for how people are using ontologies. And we gave this talk at ITSCHI in 99 and also at the Knowledge Acquisition Workshop earlier that year. Next slide, number one. So there's a handful of different things that are in our framework. Now, there is a paper that you can read to fill out the details, and you can get that paper by going to scholar.google.com and simply typing my last name and the last name of Rob Jasper, it's J-A-S-P-E-L. And you come up with the paper. So the key aspects of the framework are, one, what's the purpose of the ontology, and characterized as possible benefits or intended benefits. Another aspect is, you know, what are the principal actors? Who's doing what? And we'll look at a few examples of different actors. And most importantly, that the focus of this particular framework is really on kind of the architecture. Where does the ontology fit into the software architecture for the application that's using the ontology? What exactly does the ontology do, and when does it do it, and what other modules does it impact and interact with? And, of course, there's also other factors which are important to keep a note of when tracking ontology applications, but they're not really central to it. And we'll look at the different things there. So next slide, number two. So intended benefits. So one of the primary benefits of ontologies is so that human beings can communicate better with each other. But we're talking really applications, computer applications of ontologies, so let's skip over that one. And so there's another main thing that always comes up as a benefit for ontologies, and that's to have some form of interoperability amongst computer systems of various sorts, applications, databases, etc. Another key benefit is to improve search, and we'll look at some examples of that. And then there's actually a handful of benefits that are on the system engineering side. In other words, people building systems when they're using semantic technology and ontologies in particular, you get some very significant benefits. And the three most important things to worry about are flexibility, flexibility, and flexibility. Because that's really what you get when you're using an ontology system. So you get the ability to be more lean and agile when you're developing. Reusability goes up, reliability and consistency goes up, and all these things combine together to make maintenance easier and cheaper. And then you can do things faster, better, cheaper, but also makes new things become possible that you couldn't do before. Next, slide three. So a handful of roles, different people who do various things in the context of these scenarios that we're going to talk about. One is who's authoring ontology. Another one is the data author, people who create data based on the terminology in the ontology. And then there's the people who develop the application. So someone gave them an ontology, and now they have to use that ontology somehow in developing the app. And then, of course, there's the users of the ontology, and in some cases, we call those users knowledge workers. Slide four. So there's a lot to say about the technology stack. That's not our focus here. I'll just mention a couple of things. What's the ontology language? What kind of inference are we using? What sort of data stores and what inferencing happens over these data stores? Scale is another issue. Services are things on the cloud. There's an awful lot of things here that really need to be reported in some way, and it's like one dimension that would need to be fleshed out to some extent in this overall framework. But most of the next 10 or so minutes, I'm going to talk about particular architectures, generic ones for developing ontology applications, and a few variations. So the next slide is number 5. I'm going to highlight 4 different application scenarios. So just focus on the top. Yes.
I think your slide alignment is slightly different from the deck we are viewing. You keep on giving us one number that's lower.
Yeah, the slide I'm on right now says page 5.
No, it's changed. It's the first ontology application scenario slide is listed as page 6 on the downloaded version. But anyway, so just add 1 to you'll be all set. Right.
Okay, so I guess I'm on page 6. Top half of this page is a generic scenario that is all about having common access to information. So different agents require information. But the information is expressed in inconsistent or the wrong terms or format for their particular needs. And so the ontology is set out as an agreed standard and uses the basis for converting and mapping. So the benefits are interoperability, more effective use and reuse of knowledge. The next scenario is mutual authoring. And so the idea here is there's an ontology that is developed, and the data author uses that ontology to create data, which is then in a neutral format that can then be translated out into multiple formats. This is what I first did at Boeing. They wanted to avoid vendor lock-in, so they would do their designs in the 3D data, but they were locked into the vendor. So this is another general scenario. Next slide is slide 7. More application scenarios. The third scenario is to use the ontology really to help specify, what the software is going to do. So you build the ontology in a particular domain, for example, accounting or, genetic engineering or anything. And that really just serves as the basis for what's going to be going on in the ontology. And then you produce software consistent with that ontology. And the generation of software can be partially automated, and in some more advanced systems, you fully automate substantial aspects of the application directly from the ontology and other things. The benefit here is that it's easy to document the system because you now have the ontology as the basis for documenting what things mean, which helps with maintenance, improves reliability, and the ability to reuse information assets. The fourth and last application scenario, generic one, is search. And the essential idea here is the ontology is used to structure some body of information in a repository, and the benefit of this is better information access. So we see a lot of this these days with faceted search. They once you have an ontology for the different aspects of, say, products, those are the different facets, and those can be used to search on. Next slide is number 8. So there's a few different variations of the first one, common access information. We'll go through them. The first is data access by a shared ontology. Next slide is number 9. So this is the classic hub and spokes diagram. So the ontology is the language and vocabulary. It's a mutual interchange format. And so you express your operational data, and then you have translators that translate the data into the format required by each application. Example, again, these are old slides, so there's many examples that I could have put in here if I updated it. So PIF, PSL, a lot of the effort to create it, and that fits this basic pattern. Next slide is number 11. This is another example of Express, which is, I suppose, they're moving into the R world, I think, although I'm not sure. But essentially, that worked in a slightly different way, but it was highly analogous. Each application had what were called readers and writers, and they played the role of the translators. And what was interesting was the API, these readers and writers were generated automatically from the schema. This is the kind of thing that's being done more and more today. But what's interesting is, here we are 12 years ago, this is already a mature technology with commercial tools. Next slide, number 12. Another common, really important application of this scenario, common access information, is databases. So each database has, if you like, an implicit ontology, which might be explicit if the people developing the database had built a conceptual model, but usually they go out of sync and they're not stepped around. But the basic idea here, and this is an example of EcoSite, again, from quite a long time ago, but the same idea happens now, and there's lots of commercial tools out there. You look at the different implicit ontologies of each system, and you come up with a shared one, and you use that as the basis for a kind of a virtual data warehouse. Next, the next sub-scenario under common access information is rather than having a single ontology where you have to reach agreement and then everybody translates back and forth, instead you simply have agreement between two ontologies and then you specify a mapping, and that mapping generates a mediator. And that's a variation on the same idea, but it's architecturally different. And that's one of the main focuses I think that's going to be important in moving forward, people understanding how to use ontologies is what's the actual architecture of the system and what are the different variations and when are they useful and when not. Next slide is 14. An example, Express. Developers agreed on the mapping. The mapping was represented using Express X. The mediator was automatically generated. And this kind of thing can also be used for integrating databases. Next slide is 14. So this is another idea, using ontology as a basis for shared services. So you can automatically generate APIs based on the ontology, and that can be the basis for shared services. And the idea is you have neutrality. You're not tied to any particular language, machine, operating system, or location. And the granddaddy of all this back then, it's out of date now, but Corda. And that was used to great effect, and it's the basic idea. Some ontology authors created the ontology in some domain, say product data. The ontology was used as the basis for generating interface code for client and service, and then the client applications use the services independent of the patient operating system language on the sheet. This is all the same basic idea using ontology. So what's the supporting technology that you need to do this kind of thing? You need application interface generators, partial generators, printers, marketing team. And again, it's interesting that even way back then, and commercially, this kind of thing was mature, even though people didn't call their ontologies by that name, nor did they use all or any so-called ontology languages. But what was going on underneath architecturally is really pretty much the same. The next scenario is mutual authoring. So the idea is you author an artifact, and there's two variations here. One, you could be authoring the ontology itself and then convert the ontology into multiple formats. And this is the idea for the knowledge system understood in Stanford a long time ago. Ontolingo is really an ontology that is designed to be converted into other technology of the mutation format. So that's at the oncology level. But neutral authoring probably is more common at the data level, where the ontology is used as the basis for authoring data, and then that data is converted or translated into the format required by the different applications. So the example here is you create a workflow ontology to author workflow models, and then you could have any number of different workflow tools from different vendors that you simply map into. So now we have avoided the problem of vendor lockup, the vendor lock-in. Next slide is number 20. Ontology plays the role of the specification of some aspect of the system. So you build the ontology, and that's the basis for building out the application. So the idea is the application conforms to the ontology, and systems that are fully ontology-driven is kind of a completely seamless thing here. And partway there is when you use the ontology to build automatically generate subcodes, so it helps, but it's not the full story. And in this case, it's useful to build the ontology even as a basis for a single application because it helps in the process and it helps to maintain, and it's easier to understand what the application is about compared to if you didn't have it. But even more beneficial is when you can use that same ontology to create a variety of different application systems, which then have much greater possibility of being interoperable, as opposed to the normal situation when you don't get interoperability. So this scenario really can be thought of as one that would avoid the need to build an ontology to create interoperability later, because it's interoperability built in from the start. Next slide is number 21. So what's the benefits of this approach? Better documentation and maintenance. Things are kept in sync better. And when that's the case, reliability goes up and also the ability to reuse knowledge goes up. Next slide is 22. Another example here, again, this is going back a ways. People don't talk about CADs anymore. So conceptual modeling language is part of the CAS methodology, so you specify the ontology as the basis for a knowledge system. Other examples, data modeling tools are the basis for data schema, and even back then, Protégé was around. The ontology is built as the basis for a knowledge-based system, and the ontology really was the guided the process of knowledge acquisition. These are all examples of where the ontology, at some level, is serving to specify what kind of things go in the application and how it works. The last example, generic architecture, is called search, and it's a simple idea here. We're all quite familiar with it, but it's certainly an important one with having in our system, and that is the ontology is used to create a kind of semantic structure or a way to index the repository, and then that makes it has some possibilities of increasing the benefits of search. So, for example, again, going back then, Yahoo had a pseudo ontology, Yellow Pages, e-commerce. And these days, we see good relations is an ontology for products, and hopefully soon they'll be using that to represent products, and that will make searching for products when you go e-shopping much nicer. Okay, so that's me. I hope that you could hear me reasonably well, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, next up, we'll have Leo Oberst presenting notes on ontologies and applications. Go ahead.
Mike, just one more thing before I meant to say. I do have to drop off right now, so I won't be able to participate, but I'll catch up on the notes and I'll maybe give you a call later. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, Michael. Can everyone hear me sufficiently? Okay. You can go to slide 2 immediately. I just have a couple slides, but they're a little dense. But I'll state these, briefly. This is called advancing along the interpretation continuum. So basically that blue arrow in the middle On the left-hand side, it's the data side, if you will, where everything is human-interpreted. And on the right-hand side is the knowledge side, where computers can do the interpretation. So if you will, this is kind of like a scale of semantic interpretation between humans having to do everything on the left because you don't have knowledge structured in form of ontologies and semantic technologies. And on the right is when you do have very advanced structured information in terms of ontologies and semantic technologies. So the other items on this slide are basically some of the technologies in the blue font right below the big arrow. So information retrieval, web search, if you think of a free text search like Google, humans have to do a lot of, in fact, all the interpretation. Google and search engines will use tweak algorithms to provide a relevance ranking that's more appropriate semantically for your query, but they don't really understand the semantics of your expression. They try to do that with correlations, statistical models, etc. So as you move to the right, other technologies come into play. Text summarization, information extraction, really these things are partially structuring the data, if you will. So you're moving towards more and more computer interpretation, and the farther you go to the right, the more advanced the applications are because the computer is doing more of the semantic interpretation itself. Reasoning services, ontology induction, et cetera, complex applications. And so the boxes below that are basically what kinds of things, if you will, the use cases for that particular portion of the continuum. Far left is displaying raw documents with all the interpretation done by the human, and far right is complex machine interpretation enabling automatically spanned domain theories, institutional repositories, and complex semantic interoperability. So the red arrow moving to the right depends on increasing the automated semantic interpretation you need. So you need advanced semantic technologies and ontologies if you want to move to the right. Have computers assist by doing the interpretation, assisting you with the interpretation. The next slide, what problems do ontologies help solve? Well, almost any application you can think of, but I would say three primary ones. The data integration heterogeneous database problem, the enterprise-wide system interoperability problem, and the last relevant document retrieval question-answering problem. What all these have in common, and we'll see in the next slide again, is that they require a high degree of precision. You need to make the semantics precise, rich, and precise. Heterogeneous databases, you can address those syntactically, structurally, and semantically. Typically, databases stop at structural. They may have a conceptual model, but they refine it to a physical model, and they don't really have semantics except in maybe the data dictionary where it's not machine interpretable. Enterprise-wide system interoperability, again, in DoD world, federal government world, you're talking systems of systems, very complex structures of software. And they can't interoperate typically even syntactically or structurally, let alone semantically. And then, of course, search and document retrieval, information retrieval, question answering. You really want – sometimes you want the precise answer and as close to that as possible, which requires semantic interpretation on the part of the computer. Next slide, ontology spectrum. This, folks have seen probably the ontology spectrum that a number of folks have, including my ontology spectrum. This maps the expressivity of the semantic models against the complexity of the application. So again, as the expressivity increases, when you go from a taxonomy, which is pretty bereft of semantics, it does capture some, to a thesaurus, term-based, words and phrases, in other words, in a broader than, narrower than relationship, to more concept-based, like conceptual models, and then, of course, high-end logical theories. You can think of a logical theory as a very complex conceptual model that has a logic behind it and is focused on real-world domain information. So as you go towards the right or up to the upper right, you see that the kinds of applications that you can utilize with these models increase in complexity. So simple categorization, simple search, navigation, and indexing, a less complicated semantic model can accomplish those. Really, what we're focused on in Ontology Summit 2011 in particular, I think, is the range of applications, but more like what we would say in the logical theory realm. Where you actually have complex domain modeling, you're interested in semantic search with high precision, you're after machine semantic interpretability. So between machines and machines and machines and humans, essentially bring that machine up to the human level conceptually. And then, of course, semantic interoperability, reasoning, software services are more complex. Semantic software services are complex applications. Next slide, applications for ontologies. This is slide 6, I believe. There's a whole range of applications, and these are just another way of characterizing what those high-end logical ontologies can assist in. Discovery and mediation. So finding relevant data and services, and then assisting in mediating or fusing, composing, orchestrating both data and services. Managing trust, reputation, use and intent, the formal pragmatics, if you will, behind the semantics. Context, determination, and disambiguation, policy and security issues. So this ranges from not just data provenance, but to semantic disambiguation of entities and identity management. More and more we're seeing that within the federal government, not just people, but information sources, physical assets, infrastructure, having semantic representation. And then, of course, in the cyber world, you have to deal with thousands, potentially, of autonomous participants contributing content. Natural language processing, everything from information retrieval, information extraction, to question answering and more complex search and discovery, including, ontology induction. Analyzing text, inducing an ontology. We can't go there yet, and partial steps that we've made are assisted by having at least a starting set of ontologies that you can kind of bootstrap from. Automated reasoning. So this is where almost every application now can be brought in and applied using ontologies. Decision support, adaptive applications, think of simulation, modeling, tutoring, automated tutoring, training, electronic commerce, electronic government, very complex situational awareness, financial transaction and financial transaction, if you will, monitoring requires automated reasoning and a rich ontology. And then, of course, information mining analysis, not just finding, you know, syntactic patterns, regular expression, providing semantics for those. And then the final slide, just a kind of notional view, what do we want the future to be? With ontological models on the top, you know, we all have to address epistemological models like knowledge models, belief models. And over time, you know, in the UML world, for example, we're moving probably closer to application presentation models and platform models, eventually to get to executable code. Now, we can't go from ontologies that express the semantics to services and executable code that does what we want based upon the ontology, but that's kind of like the dream. Okay, folks, that's about all. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm going to say a few brief words now. My slides entitled Notes for an Ontology Application Framework. I just want to emphasize that that in general today, but in with my slides in particular, this is not the finished product. This is mainly trying to get some initial ideas down together, and I really foresee the next weeks and months, 2 months, trying to synthesize all the material that we're seeing and incorporating it with all the other material coming out of the other tracks. Excuse me. Okay, so if we move to slide two. Mike and Leo have already presented several kind of frameworks for the applications of ontology themselves. And I wanted to address one particular point. This is a question that I've often heard people ask, which is, okay, you're talking about an application of ontologies, but how is the ontology actually being used? And so I'm taking this as the starting point. And the idea is to, what I want to do is focus on functionality. So that each of the different applications that Mike and Leo have presented so far really incorporate one or more of these functionalities. So essentially, if we kind of use this idea, then the framework that we would be delivering as part of the summit would have at least these two tiers. There'd be this tier of addressing the basic functionality, and then above that, we would have the different kinds of applications that people are addressing in use cases that combine and incorporate different functionalities in different ways. I think the benefit of this would be that first of all, we can evaluate the benefit of using an ontology with respect to its functionality. So we can say, well, how is the ontology actually doing something either new or doing something better? And the other thing is that I think this provides a basis for benchmarks and the ability to compare different applications. And in some ways, this is like expectation management. So if someone says, I have a great application ontology for doing search, we have to guarantee that everyone really is have the same expectations of what would that really mean? How are they using that particular ontology? Or if they say I'm using ontology for decision support, well, exactly what does the ontology have to contain, and what kinds of ontologies can actually be used for decision support? So if you move to slide three, so in some cases, there'll be a lot of overlap, like I say, with my slides. One of the things we'll be doing over the next little while is like harmonizing and combining things. But the first kind of umbrella kind of application we look at is semantic integration. And there's several kind of variants of this. Again, I wanted to try to identify what the different functionalities are. And so one kind of functionality is information integration. So where you have multiple information resources that are combined using the ontologies to match concepts with similar meaning. Okay, so in this case, the ontology is providing the ability to match concepts because the ontology is representing the semantics of the concepts. So examples of this would be kind of on the informal end, things like mashups, linked data, but also looking at more sophisticated kinds of ideas where you have web service composition, data fusion, particularly in a lot of kind of industrial and intelligence applications, and then also like information aggregation. So where you have services, new services, intelligence services that are gathering information from diverse sources. I need to be able to combine them together in a semantically credible way. Another kind of functionality, instead of looking at just maybe what you might call unstructured information resources, we'll be looking at databases. So here, queries that require multiple databases are specified using common ontologies to represent the data schema or some set of ontologies, and the data schema are matched using these ontologies. And so a lot of applications of biomedical ontologies in particular are doing this kind of database integration where you need to be able to combine genome databases with protein databases, with pharmaceutical databases, perhaps the genomes from different kinds of species, even to identify kinds of commonalities. If you move to slide 4, then there's two other kinds of functionalities related to semantic integration. One is what I call software interoperability, where, and this is one of the ones that Mike raised, where you have different software systems that are exchanging information that is written using the ontology. So each software system, just a software system on this slide, sorry, uses either its own ontology or a set of shared ontologies to translate these exchange sentences. And so we've done test beds like this with TSL, where we are exchanging information between planners and schedulers and simulation engines in order to be able to do efficient manufacturing process analysis and design. The final kind of functionality related to semantic integration was proposed by Nicola Barrino. Unfortunately, he was unable to make it today, but this was from him. And it's the idea of software access. Or semantic access to software. So what we have here is that you want the ontologies to kind of detach the user vocabulary from the vocabulary of the underlying software systems. And in this way, ontologies provide a kind of a more uniform conceptual interface to various kinds of software applications. The next main kind of functionality or class of functionalities is semantic augmentation, I call it, which is slide 5. So the idea with this kind of family of functionalities is that there is an existing kind of algorithm, there's an existing application, and the ontology is kind of augmenting the underlying functionality of those particular systems. So the first kind of functionality here is what I call ontology-based algorithms. So you have an existing algorithm that is you're doing whatever it's intended to do, and the you're using the classes and relations within the ontologies to either define your search space or refine your search space or to specify heuristics to guide search. So, for example, information retrieval techniques are relevant here and natural language processing. So, again, in each of these cases, there are algorithms that are working there, and you can evaluate those algorithms in their own domain. So for information retrieval, you can evaluate the algorithms by precision and recall. And so then the an ontology-based extension of this would use ontology, say, to refine the search results to improve your precision and recall. And this would be one way, for example, we could then evaluate the benefit of an ontology in this particular, with respect to this particular functionality. The next kind of semantic augmentation is what we might consider to be how ontologies are embedded into software. So examples of this would be where you have an object-oriented implementation, for example, Java classes, that are actually generated from the classes in the ontology, for example, an OWL ontology. So you're automatically generating software or you know, some initial piece of software directly from the ontology. Another example of this would be more like manufacturing design, or manufacturing artifact or enterprise design, and you specify the design using the ontology, and then that gets exported into software. So this is related to some of Mike's examples of you're designing a particular artifact within an ontology, but then exporting it, say, to a CAD tool. A third kind of semantic augmentation is on slide 6, which is ontology-based standards, which was a topic for an earlier ontology summit 2 years ago. So in this particular approach, the terminology within the standard is axiomatized by the ontology, and then the role that the ontology plays is that conformance with the standard is then evaluated with respect to this axiomatization. So examples of this would be the units of measure ontology that's being developed as as one of the outgrowths of Ontology Summit 2009, or also various common logic axiomatizations of UML, or also OWL, I should include here, also like OWL description logic axiomatizations of UML, either UML class diagrams or UML activity diagrams. Moving on to slide 7, the next kind of category of functionalities is kind of under the umbrella of knowledge management. So this may include things like discovery, where you are using the axioms of the ontology, the various classes, to identify patterns within data. So, for example, gene sequencing and other kinds of bioinformatic applications. An ontology may be used to organize unstructured information resources by identifying different classes and relations within the ontology with the terms that appear in the resources. So this often also appears in information retrieval, but this particular kind of functionality is more related to either indexing, so you're using the ontology indexing documents, or semantic annotation, where, again, what you're doing with semantic annotation is linking particular terms that appear in unstructured data together with the concept as it's defined within the ontology. And then the third kind of knowledge management is what we might call knowledge capture, where the classes in the ontology are providing templates for gathering knowledge from subject matter experts. So we've seen this being done with a lot of maintenance kinds of procedures and standard operating procedures within heavy industries like, for example, steel. So it's capturing best practices, and the ontology is kind of driving the kind of the question-answer knowledge extraction. The final kind of application that we're looking at here on slide 8 is decision support. And in both of these kinds of functionalities, we're using the ontology directly. We're doing deduction from the axioms of the ontology directly. So this is similar to Leo's slides of the kind of on the upper kind of right-hand corner of the spectrum. And so you can think of this either as actually using theorem provers such as Racer or Prover 9, and your entailing queries can stay related to different kinds of operational management. And we've done work where we have used theorem provers such as Prover 9 in coordination with information recorded on RFID tags in order to do kind of dynamic and agile process management on a factory floor. Now, of course, theorem provers can often be very intractable, and so a variant of this kind of functionality, instead of using the ontology axioms directly in a theorem prover, you may design special purpose reasoners. So they implement sound and possibly complete algorithms to do this kind of reasoning. Examples of this would be, say, temporal reasoners, many kinds of temporal databases, and other kinds of temporal reasoners, effectively implement a time ontology via Allen's temporal relations. And although they're not always complete because they're have polynomial time complexity, they are sound and they can be used to do simple kinds of scheduling. So in conclusion, on slide 9, I said the way I see this moving forward is to, first of all, kind of have a period in which, and hopefully we begin that discussion today, combining and synthesizing all the different ideas that we've been listening to. But also, I see moving forward, this can have a lot of interaction with the other tracks. So with respect to track 2, which we heard from last week, what we want to do is identify and extract different kinds of functionalities from the applications that are discussed in use cases. And to a great extent, I kind of did these slides intentionally after last week's session. And many of these different functionalities were actually extracted from last week's use cases. I didn't get a chance to actually kind of do a formal spreadsheet type of document here to do the linking, but that's something that that we'll want to be able to do. And then finally, moving forwards, I think this can also input track three. So let's say we can evaluate the benefits of ontologies using these functionalities. I think the example we used before was if you want to demonstrate the benefit of ontologies for doing, say, search, then we can say, well, you know, we can demonstrate that ontology, you know, does, you know, benefit in that case because you can improve precision and recall. Okay, so that wraps up my slides. I'm kind of getting old to do multitasking, so I am not able to address people's chat posts while I'm talking. I'll try to get through those now while I'm listening to our next speaker, Professor Alan Rechter, who will be discussing problems arising in applications, background knowledge representation, data modeling, and ontologies. Alan, are you there?
I think I'm here now. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, fine. I'm Alan Rechter. I'm at the University of Manchester, and I've been developing various sorts of biomedical applications with various varieties of things called either knowledge representation systems or ontologies for a number of years. We're in particular involved in three sorts of applications at the moment. One of them is for ontology-driven software, where we're dealing with extremely heterogeneous sorts of things, and we use the ontology to allow us effectively to that the Java objects configure themselves at runtime based on information that they get from the ontology, or various other bits of software do so. In simple version, simply for extremely flexible questionnaire systems, it's been a small example. We're working on a much larger system. The other thing that I'm working on is the problems of how do you actually get hold of and debug a very large ontology, in this case, NOMED-CT, which is an enormous ontology used for medical applications, and which has been built with the description logic. I should say most of my work has been done for many years within at least lightweight description logics, and now is usually done within OWL. But one of my questions, and this was a framework session, and the reason I wanted to come into it was really to ask the question, is all of the things that we're doing which come under the knowledge representation headline, should they be called ontology? That, and where are the people presented the spectrum picture that is drawn? I would be much happier with something which were a multidimensional picture, because it seems to me that there are different kinds of things going on, that we have the dimensions of questions. We have questions about the actual mechanism of the knowledge representation, OWL, SCOS, RDFS, databases, and we have questions about what is actually being represented. Is it the domain, or is it the data structures at some level, or an abstraction of the data structures? And finally, in many of our applications, which are international, how language links in is absolutely critical. Move on to the fourth slide. The thing that we require, why we use description logics, and the thing that we don't want to give up. And part of my question, a lot of my talk is in essence, a frustration of working in a framework where on the one hand, I'm getting more than I ever have of some of what I need at the price of having given up a great deal. And this was crystallized. I noticed, I was amused at Mike Ushel presenting slides that were 15 years old. Part of this is one of a series of presentations that were stimulated by a very senior colleague in the medical computing world that's been around since forever, or much longer than I have, throwing up his hands at a meeting and saying, why can't we get back to 1985, when actually with key art and knowledge where it works, imagined on a modern machine. He could do some things he couldn't do today. And I'm in, you said that we're talking about architectures. I'm interested in where are the interfaces and what are the different things we're working with. So we do want to keep the description logic and the ontology. We require it particularly for composition. We work in fields that are simply too big to enumerate explicitly. If you start describing and indexing all the diseases, let alone all of the management of diseases, or trials of diseases, or diagnostic linkages for diseases under different contexts, you get into an impossibly large space, and you have to have ways of organizing it. And classification with description logic seems to be a very effective way of doing that. We've also found, and when we go to the word ontology, we haven't had Barry Smith in any of his group in any of these, but they've actually, a number of the distinctions brought in from the traditional view of ontology, of what is universally true of things in the world, are actually very useful if you try and build a system without distinguishing between people and the roles they play, or things in the world and information about them, you get into difficulty. So we don't want to give that up. But we're living in a world which uses not just OWL, but OWL and RDFS and other things, but primarily OWL. It's very clear that not everything in OWL is an ontology in that strong sense, or even necessarily in a weak sense. We have people who are using OWL to represent data representations in UML diagrams. And certainly not everything that the ontologists, in their philosophical view, want to express can be expressed in OWL or any other of our ontology languages, even in first-order logic. Clearly, some of the things that people want to say are epistemic. They go beyond what we're actually able to say easily in any representation at the moment. And most importantly, in our current applications, everybody we work with is actually, they're not interested in an ontology in the sense that the ontologist would use the word as a description of the things that are and what's universal about them. In fact, to emphasize the issue, I'll use Barry Smith's word of universal and universal knowledge. An awful lot of the information we need is a general background knowledge. It's the knowledge that things like appendicitis may cause acute abdominal pain. But that's not information that we capture in most of our logic languages, and certainly not in OWL, if we use them in a straightforward way. We can do it, but the current tools really weren't designed for that, and I've yet to see anybody who actually does it. And whether we even should be doing it is a question. The way you do it is one way to do it is to transfer everything into a form that was what we first meant when people used ontologies to represent UML diagrams and turn all of the links into classes. And then you get statements that are essentially existential statements, that there is an association between two things. I've got references on the slides to some of the work on this. And we also, but we need in the applications that we're working on. This is also, I think, probably a very important step, because one of the big distinctions that we have in our ontologies is between using them as sets of axioms in logic and using them as templates. And this comes out in both the open world, closed world distinction. And in things, it shows up specifically in issues. If you have built your database or your knowledge base or your software system using OWL, and then you go to use it to validate instances. If you do it in the naive way, your instance, they validate perfectly well, because OWL simply assumes that anything that's missing, it has an existential expression, it puts it in for you, in effect. And you have to use other techniques which haven't yet been well integrated into the kinds of tools that we're using, with the logic tools. And we suddenly come back to, as we're building these things for real people, to things, a lot of things where we used to build things in which we had inheritance with exceptions. And I won't, some of you may be old enough to have heard of, to have been to 100 talks on Tweety the Ostrich. But the simple technique of collecting all the most specific answers actually works out if you have a strong framework. It isn't a total solution to the fault logic, but missing a complete solution, it actually works, and we need it. We do need to have strengths of association. A lot of our representations actually need expressions of the form same kind. There are a whole series of things in our tools that, if we use our logic tool, we can't express. Now, practically, we go down and we use other tools, but the definition of the interfaces between these then becomes a major issue in the architecture. And it's how best the various functionalities and layers of reasoning and what the interfaces should be between them that seems to be critical at this point. We have within the same application things which need very unstructured information, and the typical ontologist habit of developing things that don't actually have a text definition, but only a formal definition, causes incredible havoc in our standards work with classification of diseases. In fact, this is something which the WHO has said they just won't tolerate. At the other extreme, without being able to have some degree of formal organization, we simply can't, and composition, we simply can't do things we need to do. We need to describe both the world, the diseases, and the particular template for what a doctor is supposed to capture about the disease, which is very different. The background knowledge, we have universal knowledge about that disease. We have contingent knowledge about that disease. We know pneumonia, by definition, is an inflammation in the lungs. We have information that's general background knowledge that it can usually be treated with penicillin. And we have an issue of the data that we're going to capture or store for patients with pneumonia when they come into an emergency room, which has to do with the various symptoms and whether or not they've been given penicillin. And they have some fields which are mandatory, which just doesn't make sense in the logic world of the open world view of the ontology. So how do these two things interface? Going on to slide 9, just briefly, the other thing which we're very interested in, which we did a great deal of in Galen in our early project 15 years ago, is that anything that involves a compositional representation or a complex representation rapidly becomes unreadable to users. And in particular, it becomes impossible for users to validate. And the ability to generate language, as well as to, we have a lot of talk, I didn't put in the slide about being able to interact with text mining, but the ability to generate language and how, what sort of linguistic objects we have in our ontology or we have in our knowledge representations is another dimension of which we're very concerned, particularly because of living in Europe and developing multilingual applications. The idea of simply putting in a single word rather than some sort of lexical or linguistic unit as a label, a quote label, as the thing that we have to display onto, is actually inadequate for a great many applications. It may work in a single language environment. It's very difficult in a multilingual environment. And the sort of architectures that would facilitate this is another dimension which we think should be in the framework for trying to understand what we want to do on ontology. And I do think that we have great difficulty getting around the issue in many of our applications that we have to treat at some level, what do we do with the information we have? What do we do in general? How do we manage the exceptions? How do we manage a large collection of exceptions? And oddly enough, we found that in spite of the fact that we know this is worst case intractable, after you have an well-structured ontology, then the old inheritance with defaults, granted that you have to have a conflict resolution strategy, often works surprisingly well. And we've used it particularly for managing user interfaces and that have to be customized to all sorts of special circumstances. So in summary, I put it in terms of the toolkit, in terms of dimensions, but I need the logic for definitions and classifications. I can't possibly enumerate or index the sorts of things that I do by hand. They're just too big. SNOMED has 500,000 concepts in it. Even small medical ontologies have 50 to 80,000. I need a toolkit and a dimension that deals with the language. I do need to be able to deal both with the universal knowledge, which fits into that logic environment, and a dimension that deals with, depending on your view and your academic background, existential, contingent, general background statements, an answer to the question which we keep getting asked in anything on OWL is how do we say may in OWL? And then none of what we do will fit within a single reasoning paradigm. And how we develop, my concern about a framework is a framework for that it includes ways to link to between different reasoning and sorts of mechanisms, whether they're defaults and exceptions, that should have actually been probabilities. And we're in a very curious situation, it seems to me, that we say we have this spectrum, but there, at least in the world groups I work with, there's a lot of siloization between people who work in RDF, people who work and linked up in the SCOTUS community, people who work in the OWL community. And the boundaries and interfaces between those seem to me at the moment to be very ill-defined. And finally, we desperately need to be able to move in the applications that we do for standards. The ultimate output is almost inevitably a UML specification and the ability to move between what we represent in whatever this is, the background representation system, including OWL and UML, and to be able to validate instances is critical. And I suppose my big question in a framework is, what sort of a vocabulary do we need for this? Is it helpful to call it all ontology? I know that's become the standard word for everything. Or do we need a more precise vocabulary for the different parts of it? Thank you. That's what I have to say.
Thank you, Alan. Okay, so that kind of wraps up the panel portion of today's session. I would like to kind of open it up now to have a kind of a broader discussion. There has been a fair bit of back and forth on the chat session, although I guess Todd just left, and I was kind of summarize his position. But I guess what we can just do is I'll just open it up and to help facilitate this kind of round, if you can, in the chat session, just click on the hand icon in the lower right, and that can establish a question queue, and I'll kind of facilitate all the different people that way. So any initial points? Well, perhaps Steve, if you could, Peter, go ahead.
The presentations today are great. Actually, all looking at the same thing that we're trying to cover from totally different perspectives and different formats of presentation. I guess, as I wrote on the chat board, is the challenge would be to effectively document and present it. So maybe we could spend a little bit of time discussing this today. Although Matthew West and I are running a track of four that is supposed to focus on strategies on making the case, and I definitely need input from this group or from this session to help sort of formulate that. Thanks.
Okay. Steve, did you want to kind of basically summarize, because I think you and Todd seem to be on the same wavelength there.
Yeah, thanks. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, basically I'm just wrestling myself with framing this in the context of the overall summit, in the sense that I put that little arrow sequence in the chat board of keeping in mind that what we want to provide a user of the output of this summit with is a tool to say, okay, I've got this kind of problem. This is the kind of functionality that problem will call for, and here's the strategy I can use to pitch the application of that functionality, and here are the benefits that I can convey for that. So that's kind of, in my own mind, a sequence that would go through, but of course it's not always quite that simple, and I'm just, I was raising the issue in the chat as to which track might address each of those categories of problem, basically, and was curious about your thoughts on that.
I see that's a pretty valuable kind of approach. I guess I was kind of moving towards that with the functionalities, although the idea of the actual problem being addressed by the functionality was implicit. But I think it would be within the scope of this track to kind of augment this framework with the different problems that are being addressed by the, kinds of the ideas that we're presenting today. I kind of saw the idea of having the kind of degree of detail for functionality as being important for discussing benefits. Right? Because if you want to be able to demonstrate a benefit, then that has to be kind of a form of, are we doing something new? And in case, what is that new thing you're doing? So identify what is that, what is new. Or you're improving something. And so in order to say what you are improving, to say out of precision and recall, or you're reducing the cost of a manual integration project, it kind of falls back onto whatever piece of functionality the ontology was intended to deliver. So I guess moving on the other direction would be a good idea.
Yeah, in fact, let me just jump in and say, of course, the benefit side is going to speak directly to track three on the value metrics, the value models, which I believe we're going to try to remember now which week we're having that session. But that presumably will enumerate things like cost or performance or capability, different kinds of dimensions of benefit. So that will tie
right.
in very nicely.
Right. And see, I mean, it's kind of like a chicken and egg problem. On the one hand, it would be good for this framer to kind of emerge from the use cases and from the benefits tracks at the end. On the other hand, it's also useful to have an initial framework that can be used to start kind of structuring the conversation. Like I said, a lot of these functionalities that I presented today, I can trace back to different use cases I presented last week. So to some extent, the framework I was presenting came out from those. So, we can kind of, I think there's a kind of a lot of interactions we can try to capture here. And then, but I think you're right, one thing that's missing would be the problems. And I guess that was kind of implicit in the quadrant style presentation last week. So perhaps I need to pay a little more attention to that quadrant of their slides to identify different classes of problems.
Yeah, but I think we're in great shape in terms of having this framework, I think, is really looking good.
Okay, so let's see here. Rom, we use the track's title is Application Framework. I presume you're going to synthesize presentations into a framework perspective. Rom, can you just elaborate a little bit more on what you mean by a framework? Because it's sort of what was implicit in at least in my slides. And like I said, there's a some harmonization needs to be done, but what more do you see as being in a framework?
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, because I'm kind of using this new BlackBerry which I got and trying to figure it out. Okay. The thing is that we talked about, the thing is about an application framework, okay? Now, what's an application framework you're talking about?
I was asking you.
Yeah. So, the title says application framework, okay? Now, what is an now we got to get the semantics of this application framework straightened out now. What I was looking at more in terms of a framework should help people, suppose I have an application X, I should be able to place it appropriate dimensions of this framework. So you're going to define a number of dimensions, number of criteria, some metrics for this framework and things like that, not metrics really, dimensions of this framework and so on. You have, the things are spread all across the place in the slides that the presenters have their excellent set of slides, but we need to synthesize that into a system, into something where you can have some kind of a multidimensional kind of framework, and you can put things in the appropriate axis.
Okay.
I'm just trying to figure out what the issue of the frame, what do you mean by an application framework here as well?
Well, I mean, people have used this frame, this word multidimensional. Did you give some examples of dimensions?
For example, you're talking about one of the ontology spectrum people talk about in terms of where things are in terms of the representation schemes, okay? So then there could be another dimension you can talk about the applications part of it and this thing. For this particular application, this kind of a thing suffices, okay, representation. But if you're using this application, if you're using search, and depending on what kind of search technique you're using, you may need ontologies or may not need depending on what applications, you might only want a simple table lookup or something like that. Do you see what I'm saying? So, and then there may be another dimension of the maturity of the ontologies and testability of the ontologies, evidence these ontologies are indeed the right ontology, evidence of the testability of these ontologies and things like that. So that's what I'm kind of looking at a framework perspective. So I don't know what your what the consensus here on an application framework is.
I was primarily since I see you the last person standing in the panel, although Alan can jump in. I was kind of seeing the framework as less a multi-dimensional spreadsheet. And more of a kind of a classification of different uses of ontologies. And but I mean, I agree with you that it has to be to the level of detail sufficient to, you know, kind of manage expectations, right? And to be able to support benchmarking. So if you say, you know, use case where I had this great success, somebody else should kind of know enough that about that problem in order to know that that solution may or may not be applicable to them. I was mainly looking at a classification scheme in that sense.
But yeah, so maybe we need to make it explicit then, that's about it.
Well, no, I mean, we're all kind of working on this together. I mean, none of us really know exactly what's going on. I mean, what we can do is, start setting up the, I mean, if we can start this in a thread online and start gathering what people might consider to be dimensions, maybe then this is just the different ways in which we are doing the classification. Yeah, I mean, let's start the online conversation with possible dimensions or also possible ways of, like, pick your favorite use case from last week, for example, and kind of describe how it would fit into a framework that you're thinking of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think there are classic dimensions, this is Alan Rector speaking, such as how much inference is built into the ontology and how much is in the queries that you make of the ontology. If you have an RDS store, an awful lot of the knowledge is in the Sparkle or whatever queries you make of it. If you have something in OWL, it may be more in the classification. If you have another sort of dimension, is to what extent does this expect to represent the real world? To what extent is it something which is supposed to be directly translatable into software and be concerned, something which gets concerned with data structures? There are other dimensions which just have to, dimension is perhaps the wrong word. There are issues about functionality needed for different applications, and that some sort of list of functionalities. Obviously, everybody would like everything. excuse me. Some things I think fit into a notion of dimension, or the, and into distinctions, which I think people need to be aware of when they buy one or another of the tools and whatever, that there really are differences between tools which are logic-based and tools which are template-based, and that those have effects on what they're going to do with them and how close they're going to meet different kinds of expectations. So it's matching those things. And the other question, we've talked about dimensions, but the question of interfaces, I don't think we're going to end up with one thing. We're going to end up with various sorts of things that have to interact. And so the question of how do you describe each thing and the interface it has to have with another artifact is part of what I think of as a framework.
Okay, I guess like another way of addressing this too, maybe is bottom up. So, what role do people see the use cases playing? Right. I mean, I kind of saw again the use cases providing some of the existing applications of ontologies, and what Track One is doing is again trying to kind of classify and organize these different applications so that you know, we can. Kind of again communicate exactly how an ontology is being used. So how do other people see, say, the use cases feeding into the Track One idea of an ontology application framework? Go ahead, Peter.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Well, okay. I guess one of the things. Maybe this was even discussed a little bit during the organizing committee meetings, was that if we can at least classify the applications with some sort of means or the use of ontology in those applications to at least debunk notions like, I mean, someone who had said ontologies are overrated, or maybe ontologies don't apply. Maybe it's just a certain representation or a certain form of quote-unquote ontology. I mean, assuming we accept the entire spectrum of artifacts and call them in general ontologies, you know, it's easy for people who don't have a very clear notion to say, oh, ontologies don't work when certain forms of ontology doesn't work very well with certain requirements or certain applications. If we could at least categorize and present enough to help the community effectively explain that position to people who don't understand well, I mean, that might be helpful.
Okay, so then what would be kind of the direction to go from here then? What's kind of missing from what we've heard today that we need to be kind of focusing on over the near future here?
Well, since I'm top of the queue, it looks like this is Steve Ray. I did want to sort of tangentially address that by saying I think what we want to do in the kind of categories you've laid out, Michael, try and identify as many concrete examples as possible, even if we don't have the, if you like, ROI data associated with them. It helps to keep it from getting too abstract in terms of just categorization, and that'll feed back to the case studies where possible.
Right. So kind of again, you know, kind of match the material we've seen today back to say last week's case studies and future case studies. I agree.
Right.
Amanda?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Picking up on those last couple of comments, I also want to suggest that the part of what gives us insight into what the dimensions and distinctions are the use cases and their lessons learned. And some of you will remember from last year's summit that I have long been turning over this idea of trying to figure out how to collect not just use cases, but what worked and what didn't work in the different use cases as a way to move us towards best practice understanding that or collective knowledge that we don't have. But I think in the same light, the fact that a particular approach worked in one use case and didn't work well in another often is just the light one needs to figure out what was the important difference between those cases or what were the differences that one can pick out. So I think that kind of comparative conversation about not just the cases but how they were solved or what failures there were can give even more ground into the distinctions of dimensions or place or values on those dimensions. That's all.
Oh, no, that's a great point. And that's often the best way to proceed. Unfortunately, no one presented any failures last week. So I'll take an open call for failures of ontologies, maybe for the next use case. But that's exactly the way to go.
It's a very hard thing to do. I've submitted a couple of proposals for workshops to different conferences to do this, to talk about the lessons, like the use cases with the lessons learned. And either I'm presenting it very badly or no one thinks it's especially interesting. So it is a very hard conversation to get going. But I think it's valuable on so many different levels. It's a bit agitating for me.
Pat Martin.
Yes, I think getting people to talk about failures is always extremely difficult. I mean, there are certainly some very big issues in a number of the very large, I'm not sure whether to call them knowledge representation or ontologies or terminology projects in the medical area, but certainly one of the risks of the projects is that they take on a life of their own and become overbloated and disconnected from their application. One of the things that was interesting to me last week was that even the ontologies which were spanning more than what were meant to be integrating things, were integrating very specific things that had a very clear focus to them. If you take things like the medical standard HL7 version 3, or arguably SNOMED, which may yet succeed, but after about 20 years, the front-loading and the difficulty of establishing what the criteria are going to be are major issues. But trying to get somebody to talk about those kinds of things, I'm not sure how that would fit into the sort of thing Pat has in mind. There's certainly risks to be avoided in ontology development, and we would at the moment put on top of our list getting something that's overly front-loaded. Don't know if that helps at all.
Pat, you can
end up. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you. This is my first exposure to this community, so I just kind of put a long thread there, and thank you for that comment just now. Put a long thread in the chat box about what we're looking at. We don't have an ontology at the moment. We're just at the beginning, so any lessons learned by others who begin this journey would be greatly appreciated. And if you guys could let me know a place where I could find that information. And so I guess that's it. We're looking for search engine optimization. Our data set is complex and compound, and frankly, we can't really search it effectively ourselves. So we are looking to create an ontology for our internal functionality as well as, I like to say, search engine optimization to make our data more harmonious with the rest of the content on the web. And specifically, the reason why it's not so harmonious right now is because we make no distinction between the various disciplines. So the search engine logic that tends to look at things as weird as word proximity makes our content look less and less like a specific subject because we cross many dimensions in our content or in many disciplines in our content. So we want to figure out a way, and we're thinking topic pages is the best way to do that, and having an ontology to generate a topic page index, an automated way to generate a topic index is something we're really looking at. And of course, then I also mentioned that we're looking for making our data searchable multilingually. So that's kind of it. I mean, like I say, this is my first exposure to this community. We're very new, starting out creating, adding an ontology to our application. And so any heads up, any lessons learned, like I say, would be greatly appreciated as we begin this whole process.
Oh, thank you, Pat. And welcome to the group. Are there any other points? Steve,
you have
your hand up.
Sorry, I was muted. Okay, can you hear me?
Yes.
I just had a question I typed to Pat on the chat board, but basically just asking whether she could expand a little bit on what is the nature of her data set so that we can sort of think about that a little bit.
Pat is dialing back in. I guess one thing I made up just to put out there as well, when people are thinking of a framework, so their expectations of what they're, within their minds when they're thinking of the application framework, was it close to the idea of having some kind of template for specifying use cases? So in other words, how do you describe a use case? I would include things like identifying what ontologies were used, the various functionalities that they were supporting, the problem that was being addressed, the architecture that was the architecture of the overall kind of application and where the ontology fits into that. Is that what other people were thinking of when they were thinking about the framework?
That's what I was thinking of. Sounds good to me.
Patch could be.
To what extent does the format that people were using last week already kind of capture that? I guess it was kind of, there's certain things that need to be made more explicit out of that, but I guess that would be another kind of input to this discussion.
Hmm. Yeah, this is Steve again. I think it's just a question of, yes, interpreting the use cases that were put forward, you know, in essentially categorizing, as you were saying, but exactly those, what some might call dimensions that you just went through right there. What's the problem? What kind of functionality was being applied, et cetera? Those are exactly the right characterizations, I think, to try and identify explicitly for each of those use cases.
Okay, so that'll be one of the things we try to get done over the next few weeks online is doing that kind of that kind of mapping and analysis.
Mm-hmm.
Peter.
Yes, I was wondering if Pat Bachman is back online. Concur with Michael, so welcome to the community. I would also like to point out you are in the Ontology Summit community, and we also welcome the fact that you've joined Ontolog Forum. So, I mean, to segregate the conversation, I just wanted to point out Ontolog Forum is sort of the general ontology discussion. So some of the questions you might have might apply there, or if you toss a question out to that mailing list, you might be surprised to get some very educated answers. The summit here is revolving around the theme of making the case for ontologies. So this is the particular focus that we want to sort of frame the conversation. So just wanted to highlight the fact that your questions might go different ways depending on who you are addressing and which mailing list you're putting it into. That's it. Back to Michael.
Okay. Well, we have, I guess, 10 minutes left. I suppose if there aren't any kind of additional comments that people want to make now, you know, I'll just encourage everyone to kind of start conversations online. In different discussion threads, and because I think that's, if Peter's made this point before, that, I mean, most of the work for the summit is really supposed to happen beforehand, and so this is the kind of the kickoff meeting for Track 1 to get that work going. I suppose if there aren't any additional comments that people have, we could finish now. Peter, did you want to say any words about the upcoming meetings?
Yes, just brief announcements, most of you probably have already seen that on the mailing, the ontolog invitation list or other mailing list here. And we've already, announced the next three sessions. So, and they are coming up in the immediate next three Thursdays. Next week we will have track two, the use cases. People do another panel and present another bunch of good use cases as references. And then after that, track three will have the kickoff session. Essentially, that's the track doing value metrics and value models. And after that, track four will have a session trying to discuss what strategies to use when trying to make the case for ontologies. So mark your calendar. It's the same time every week for the next 3 weeks. Actually, for the rest of the Thursdays until our face-to-face at NIST in Gaithersburg, Maryland, on April 18th and 19th. So be with us. Thank you. And back to Michael.
Okay, thank you, Peter. So, again, if there aren't any additional comments, I can see people still typing in the chat, but I believe the chat goes on even after we've disconnected from the conference call. So I'd just like to thank everyone. I'd like to thank my fellow panelists, Michael Eschel, Leo Overs, and Alan Rechner. I'd like to thank everyone else for attending and chat session. And encourage everyone to contribute to the ongoing development of this framework. Again, just the beginning. And talk to everyone next week.